Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The UN is forced to cut food aid to Africa, and African health ministers meet to address the Ebola outbreak. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The United Nations World Food Program is reducing food aid to nearly 800,000 refugees in Africa. The agency says the cuts of 40 to 60% will affect refugees in the Central African Republic, South Sudan, Chad, Uganda, Mauritania, Mozambique, Ghana, Liberia, and Burkina Faso. This is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres.
We are facing, for the refugees in Africa, a food security crisis. And this food security crisis needs to be addressed. And the way to address it is to provide to the World Food Programme the additional resources that the World Food Programme needs to reestablish a normal support to refugees in Africa.
The UN says 2.4 million refugees across the continent depend on its agencies for food. Health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting today in Ghana. They are discussing how they should respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola. The World Health Organization is leading the two-day conference in the Ghanaian capital of Accra. It announced that 467 people have now died from Ebola in West Africa this year. A cargo plane has crashed into a building in Kenya's capital, killing four people on board. The plane hit the two-story building housing two small shops shortly after takeoff early today from Nairobi's main airport. Investigators say it may have hit an electrical pole before crashing. Violence continued in eastern Ukraine today, a day after the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, ended a 10-day unilateral ceasefire and resumed a military offensive against pro-Russian separatists. A spokesman for Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council said at least five Ukrainian servicemen were killed and 21 wounded over the previous 24 hours, while hundreds of rebel fighters died in the fighting. As delegates from Iran and six world powers arrive in Vienna for a marathon final round of talks, Iran says it's ready to take concrete steps to ensure its nuclear program remains peaceful, but would not kneel in submission. Speaking in a video message posted on YouTube, the Iranian foreign minister urged negotiators to use mutual respect in negotiations rather than what he called a spiral of escalation. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy is under formal investigation in a tangled corruption inquiry that risks derailing his widely anticipated political comeback. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports.
Ex-President Nicolas Sarkozy returned home Wednesday with the news he is under formal investigation after spending an unprecedented 15 hours in police custody outside Paris. Magistrates are looking into whether Mr. Sarkozy used his influence to interfere with a probe into alleged irregularities involving his 2007 election campaign. His lawyer and a high-ranking judge are also under investigation. Mr. Sarkozy has vehemently denied all allegations of misconduct, suggesting they are politically motivated. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
A load of Syrian chemical weapons has arrived at an Italian port for destruction. It fulfills an international agreement in the midst of Syria's civil war. A Danish freighter accompanied by a military helicopter brought the weapons to a port under heavy security. There, a U.S. military ship waited to transport them to international waters, where about half of the cargo will be destroyed at sea. The rest will be destroyed at plants in the United States and Europe. Among the cargo are supplies of mustard gas and agents used to make sarin nerve gas. U.S. prosecutors say the militant accused of carrying out the deadly 2012 attacks on American outposts in Benghazi, Libya, was motivated by his extreme anti-Western fervor. American authorities have detailed some of their allegations against the suspect, Ahmed Abu Qatala, before a detention hearing set today in Washington. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Yusuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Villagers here tell VOA that the scarcity and price hikes have impacted their holy obligation during Ramadan, when Muslims are supposed to share food with the underprivileged. But Imam Ibrahim Amadu says Muslims here can forgo certain obligations during this hardship. And he says many may skip the requirement to fast during daylight hours if it is affecting their health.
That's VOA's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from a border village in Cameroon. Details coming up.
Also in the news, a small cargo plane has crashed into a building in Kenya's capital, and health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting in Ghana to discuss and respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Muslims in Cameroon are observing Ramadan in the face of serious price hikes for food due to border closures to protect against incursions from the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. Nigeria supplies up to 80% of food in North Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited Amchade, an affected border village, and files this report.
Here at Amchide, the normal bustling trade with Nigerian businesses is at a standstill. Local Imam Ibrahim Amadu says Cameroon soldiers closed the border just ahead of Ramadan as a security measure against Nigeria's Boko Haram militants, who have been plaguing this part of Cameroon in recent months with theft, kidnappings, gun running, and attacks. He says the problem for his village is Nigeria is the main source of food and traders are nervous.
80% of our rice is imported. It's very risky for a businessman to carry rice knowing that there's going to be a problem. Even maize, you also have oil, we have sugar. In fact, all the food that Muslims need during the month of the Ramadan, there's a problem. Because of this barbaric act of Boko Haram, most of the businessmen will not want to come in.
At the Amchide Motor Park, shoe vendor Haliru Kakoi tells VOA that some foodstuffs are no longer available and others, like sugar, now sell for 50% higher.
Jottabe digabe mabbe frontier gal Nigeria do warti kujeji man fu chadi ko pade soso be
kujeji. He says everything is becoming expensive and some prices have doubled. Consequently, no one wants to buy and business is at a standstill in their market. 9 out of 10 people in Amchide make their money through trade, and so the border closure and ensuing inflation has hit household incomes hard. Sumu Bakari says he used to make about $200 a day, but now he barely eggs out $50.
Quand le marché est bon, je peux même souvent laisser même 5,000. Et quand c'est mauvais, je peux même laisser même 1,000 francs.
He says he's had to cut food money during Ramadan from $10 to $2, and his family is struggling. Villagers here tell VOA that the scarcity and price hikes have impacted their holy obligation during Ramadan, when Muslims are supposed to share food with the underprivileged. But Imam Ibrahim Amadu says Muslims here can forgo certain obligations during this hardship. And he says many may skip the requirement to fast during daylight hours if it is affecting their health.
According to the Islamic law, they can drop the fasting if the prices are too high in such a way that they cannot be able to afford those basic needs during the month of the Ramadan. After that, when the prices drop, they can then fast.
Cameroon's Minister of Trade, Luc Magouan-Balgatangana, tells VOA the government plans to assist the North during Ramadan.
Le gouvernement est vigilant et nous n'accepterons pas de débordement sur.
He says the government is concerned about the impact of price increases and is discussing ways to make available basic commodities such as maize, rice, fish, palm oil and flour. Strict border security measures are expected to impact trade long after Ramadan and hit Nigerian business as well. Nigeria buys quite a large quantity of cotton, sorghum, or grain crop for animal feed, maize, rice, and onions from North Cameroon, and there are huge piles of stock sitting or rotting. Both governments are actively fighting Boko Haram, but militants appear to be intensifying their five-year-old insurgency and remain a threat for the foreseeable future. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Amchide.
Nairobi police say four people died when a small cargo plane crashed into a building in Kenya's capital. The pilot, co-pilot, navigator and cargo handler died in the fiery crash. The plane was taking off under foggy conditions from a private airfield near the building. The only occupants of the two-story building of commercial shops were two guards. Both were injured. The plane was bound for Somalia with a load of cod, a plant whose leaves are a popular mild stimulant in the region. Cod is grown on plantations throughout East Africa and exported to Middle Eastern countries.
Also in East Africa, the Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF, accuses Seleka fighters in Central Africa of fighting alongside declared terrorists of the Lord's Resistance Army. A Seleka spokesman denied cooperating with the LRA. The charge was made today after clashes on Sunday and Monday, in which 15 Seleka and several Uganda troops died. A Seleka official confirmed the deaths yesterday, but he said the Ugandan forces mistook the Seleka as LRA members. The UPDF spokesman replied today that the Seleka are in bed with LRA fighters. The mostly Muslim Seleka forces formed 2 years ago and ousted the government of the Central African Republic in Bangui. Their brief rule under Michel Djotodia degenerated into a sectarian war with Christian Community Defense Forces called Anti-Balaka. Uganda is participating in an African Union peacekeeping force targeting units of the LRA and their Ugandan leader, Joseph Kony. Kony has been charged with human rights abuses by an international criminal court in The Hague, Netherlands. While about 100 U.S. special forces are assisting the 5,000 AU troops, the U.S. State Department said none were involved in the weekend clash. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 13 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A small cargo plane has crashed into a building in Kenya's capital. And health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting in Ghana to discuss and respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola. And Muslims in Cameroon are observing Ramadan in the face of serious price hikes. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A delegation from the Uganda Electoral Commission has completed a week-long visit to Malawi to study voter education processes. But as Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre, some analysts question whether Uganda can learn anything from Malawi's recent flawed elections.
Uganda has less than 2 years to prepare for the national elections, and this time, election officials say they want to do a better job. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday in Blantyre, the director of operations at the Uganda Electoral Commission, Leonard Mulekwa, explained why his three-person delegation came to Malawi.
We did our last election in 2011, and we did post-election review. And the population and the political parties told us we did not do enough voter education. We're following the Malawi elections, and what we're seeing were big turn-up of people at rallies, big turn-up of people at registration centers. So we thought maybe there's something Malawi is doing to mobilize these people, which we may not be doing.
Malawian officials brought their Ugandan counterparts to civil society groups, which were instrumental in getting information to the electorate. Mulekwa says they can learn a lot from groups like Malawi's National Initiative for Civic Education, which distributed information about voting in public places.
For example, if you look at things like procession walks, going to health units when mothers are transnational, their immunization, going to marketplaces, you know, writing letters to parents, writing letters to all categories of leaders. These were very new initiatives to us, and we think we have picked a lot of lessons from here, which when we go back, of course, we are going to urge the commission to adopt.
However, some analysts are raising eyebrows at the idea any country could learn from Malawi after the elections in May were marred by the widespread irregularities. Jessica Bwira, spokesperson for the opposition Malawi Congress Party, said she thinks the Ugandan delegation was not given the true picture of how Malawi conducted its voter registration.
For example, civic and voter education was problematic from an ethnic perspective. There was regionalism in the way NEC did it. When they came to the central region, it was all done at one time. Yet in the other places, specifically in the south, voter education was done first and then the voting happened later. But with the central region, there was very weird things happening. Some of the places did not even get voter education.
The Malawi Electoral Commission says there weren't enough official complaints at any stage of the electoral process. Ernest Tindo was a political science lecturer at the Chancellor College of the University of Malawi. He says Uganda should look at not only what Malawi did well to prepare for the elections, but what it didn't do well. Shortages of ballot papers and ink sparked anger among voters in some polling centers in Blantyre.
One of the challenges Malawians had was not having necessary materials in polling centers at the right time. So that's an area where Uganda needs to learn that there can be some areas where, if not properly executed, can lead to problems. So overall, there are both positive and negative things Uganda can learn and be attentive to areas where Malawi might have failed.
Opposition groups in Uganda have long complained of irregularities in the country's elections. Long-time President Yoweri Museveni has won the last three elections amid allegations of bribery, intimidation, and violence. Attempts by the opposition to challenge the elections in court have been futile. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting today in Ghana to discuss how they should respond to the deadliest ever outbreak of Ebola. The World Health Organization is leading the two-day conference in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, after announcing that 467 people have now died from Ebola in West Africa this year. Guinea has been the hardest hit, with 303 deaths attributed to Ebola since April. The overall numbers are lower in Sierra Leone and Liberia, but both countries have reported a sharp increase in cases and deaths from the highly contagious disease in the past month. The other countries taking part in the conference include Ivory Coast, Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Mali, Senegal, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The WHO is calling for a strong response to contain the outbreak, particularly in the area where Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia share a border.
19 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new drug to fight the drug-resistant form of tuberculosis, DRTB, has been approved by South Africa's Medicines Controls Council, MCC. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders is celebrating what it calls a victory for the generic use of linezolid, a high-strength antibiotic used to treat patients with DRTB. The aid organization, also known by its French acronym MSF, had been using the expensive drug drug and individualized drug regimens to treat patients with the disease. However, with the MCC approval of the generic drug, MSF will be allowed to treat more patients at a significant cost savings. Julia Hill is MSF's advocacy officer for South Africa. She spoke with me about the significance of the approval of the new drug.
MSF has been trying to get access to a more affordable version of this product for the past 3 years, and we were finally able to do so by applying with the Medicines Control Council of South Africa, which is the regulatory authority, for special permission to import a generic into South Africa. So this application was based on the unaffordability of the product that was available in South Africa, and it's quite a significant first step, actually, because it means that other healthcare providers within South Africa, including the National Department of Health, could actually do the same thing to try and get access to this generic product and expand access to other tuberculosis patients in South Africa. It really could open up access to hundreds of patients who could benefit, if not thousands of patients across the country. The other kind of exciting thing is that it could mean that we would actually have a product fully registered in South Africa in the near future, which would do the same thing actually without having to get this special permission. It would allow the product to be used in South Africa to treat drug-resistant TB patients.
How is this particular drug being used right now?
Right now, MSF is one of a small number of healthcare providers in South Africa who's providing it to patients who have extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, which means that they're resistant to most of the drugs that are used to treat TB. And really, right now, the treatment options that we have for drug-resistant TB, they aren't very good. So patients need to take thousands of pills over 2 years. They have to deal with painful injections and really terrible side effects. And less than half the patients that actually start the treatment are cured. So we really need shorter and more efficacious regimens. And we finally have some new TB drugs coming to market, as well as drugs like linezolid, which show quite a bit of promise in treating TB, even though that's not what they were originally designed for. So linezolid really could play a very key role in designing a better treatment regimen. But right now, it is within the World Health Organization guidelines and the national guidelines in South Africa for patients with extensively drug-resistant TB. And we just really need to make sure that these key drugs are actually available at affordable prices if we want to be able to scale up access to them.
Will the generic form of linezolid be available only in South Africa?
It's sold in a number of countries, the original product. In South Africa, what this means is that actually MSF is the only actor within South Africa that will have access to this generic at a price that's about 88% lower than the 700 rand price tag that we're currently purchasing it at in the private sector. I guess it points to the need to actually have affordable medicines available in many other countries, because South Africa isn't the only country where there's a monopoly supplier that is selling at an exorbitantly high price. So we think that it's a very big step forward in terms of promoting access to affordable medicines. And we're hopeful that other countries can also find solutions where there are barriers to accessing affordable versions of linezolid.
Do you all have any concerns in using the generic form of linezolid?
No, so the product that MSF is using is registered by the UK regulatory authority. It's also approved by the Global Fund for purchase in Global Fund eligible countries in treating TB. And MSF also follows national guidelines and has additional protocols in place to monitor how linezolid is used. But this product is equivalent to the original product and will be used in accordance with national guidelines.
That was Julia Hill, MSF's advocacy officer for South Africa. She spoke with me from Johannesburg.
The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, has declared that its chief, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is the leader of a new caliphate, a historical term to denote a sovereign state for the Muslim faith. The term was last widely recognized to describe the government of the Ottoman Empire. ISIS was once al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq, but the terror group's leaders disowned the group early this year for its desire to carve out a caliphate and refusing to obey orders. Paul Selin is the Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute. VOA's Susan Yaki asked for his reaction to a new caliphate being declared in Iraq and Syria.
It adds a new level, a new dimension to the dramatic events that have been taking place over the last few weeks. I think it indicates that ISIS or ISIL is thinking of a long-term presence in a large geographic space, a big part of Iraq and Syria. I had written previously that I think this is a development which will be with us for a long time, because the Shiite-led governments both in Baghdad and Damascus have failed to bring in the Sunnis. And this sort of breakaway by Sunni communities at this point, using ISIS or accepting ISIS as a spearhead, reflects a larger political, you know, malaise or, you know, division in the region. I don't think ISIS's dominance in this region will be uncontested or necessarily very long term. I think the fact that they went ahead and declared a state, as it were, might in fact bring them even more rapidly into conflict with other groups in these contested zones. At the same time, I think this declaration does reverberate around the Islamic world among radicals and jihadis, that this is sort of putting forward a sort of the skeleton of a new project, which is to bring back the caliphate. This has been part of Islamist radical discourse for a whole century, since the caliphate was abolished by the Turks in 1924. So this will resonate and might have sort of reverberations in other countries and communities who might look favorably at this development. So I think it's significant. It complicates the situation even more than it was. But it will not, be uncontested. It won't be as if they're just going to go ahead and set up an Islamic State and a caliph, and that's just going to be accepted as part of the normality. But it does throw a new concept into the mix.
How should the international community react to this, or should they react at all?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's much to react in terms of the declaration or not. This is a group that, you know, Al-Qaeda declares things, this group declares things. It's not as if there is now a caliphate that one has to, you know, take positions for or against. So I wouldn't necessarily think that the international community per se needs to react to the declaration. I think that is more something of concern to the Muslim world, Islamic countries, for whom, you know, this is part of their history and positions as Islamic societies or states. They will definitely take positions about, largely, I mean, would imagine nobody will accept it. I don't think the West needs to, you know, react to it per se. The West needs to, and the international community needs to react to, you know, what's going on, broadly in Syria and Iraq, the disintegration effectively of that entire part of the Middle East. Obviously, great loss of life, great instability, a great risk to security, not only in the region, but also Western security, since there are hundreds of Western fighters fighting in Syria and Iraq with these jihadi groups, and some of them are already coming home and do pose a risk. The West really has not had a policy, or at least an effective policy, to deal with this double crisis of Syria and Iraq, and they really sort of have merged into one terrible, perfect storm. That needs addressing. But the caliphate, if somebody announces a caliphate, I don't think necessarily the international community needs to take a position on it.
Paul Saleen, Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute, he spoke to VOA's Susan Yaki. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
VOA. Way, Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.